Yes, I'm probably going to speak, I guess, for about 45 minutes. I'll try to keep to that time, because I'm sure you probably all have incredible... I imagine you have a lot of opinions about the election, and I'm not going to be able to cover as much as I would like. I sort of tried to rewrite this today because after speaking with some of the faculty, I decided to... The subject of the talk was... And I want to get to the major subject, which is not only the election, but what I consider to be probably the biggest puzzle of all, which is why it is that economically downwardly mobile U.S. workers support a president who makes their plight worse. It's possibly the most important question to ask about the future of democracy in the U.S., in my view, and I hope very much to address that in the latter part of the talk. But before doing that, I wanted to address some of the larger issues about this particular election. And because I'm speaking to a Canadian audience, you have to excuse me, because I've been really trying to grasp the level of knowledge that people have in Canada about the electoral process. So I might be under your heads or over your heads. I'm hoping to strike a kind of balance of... you know, a moderate amount of knowledge about the U.S. and its particular and its peculiar politics. And actually, it's also, I have to apologize too, because it's very hard for me to talk about this 2 weeks after the deed was done, because personally, my wife and I, and many people I know, of course, are very engaged in this election, and we, for once in my life, anyway, I thought that we were actually going to win. So it was kind of dashed to my hopes on Wednesday morning as I arrived back from Pennsylvania early in the morning on Wednesday, and found that probably that wasn't going to happen, and it's only gotten worse since then. So with that in mind, I want to just, first off, just turn to these maps, which are reprinted in the New York Times, and I want to do really three things. I want to first give a really very brief overview of some of the things that are new about this election, some of the things that are old about this election, and then try to address some of the major interpretations which have already arisen about it. So first, let's look at some of the maps, and I'm sure most of you are familiar with the red-blue state dichotomy, right? This is not something that's going to be alien to you, right? I hope? Yeah. If we look at the first map, which is the one that has the title on it, red and blue, a divided electorate in all of its shades, one of the things that's fairly extraordinary about it, and kind of terrifying if you look at it from a Democratic Party perspective or even a left perspective of any kind, is the degree to which, if you look at the territory of the United States, most of it is, without any question, red. These dots on this map represent margins of victories in every county in the United States. And as you can see, there's lots of huge blue globules, which are concentrated almost entirely around the large metropolitan or cosmopolitan cities in the United States, with the exception of most of the, or some at least, of the southern cities, including most notably Oklahoma, Dallas, Texas, Tulsa, Oklahoma. And the blues get pretty small, actually, in the south, even in the large cosmopolitan areas. So the image that's portrayed by this map, actually, is one in which there is basically a gigantic right-wing tide territorially, which is represented ironically by the red dots, which are slowly surrounding and drowning, I suppose, the cosmopolitan centers on the two coasts. And then there's these old industrialized centers in the Midwest, Chicago, Detroit, etc., which are more or less hanging in there. Now, this map, in a way, is deceptive, and it's the map that we often see. If we turn to the second group of maps, we will see on the far left top, you'll see the standard map of the states that are won by the Democrats, and the two states of Iowa and New Mexico, which were undecided when this map was published, are now in the Bush column. So that's a sea of red right there, too. Those are two states won by Kerry. Run by the Democrats in 2000, which are now decided for Bush. So if we look at this map, it even becomes more of a sense that you can fly from Washington, D.C. to San Francisco and never cross a state that votes Democratic. What's a little deceptive about it, however, is if you look to at the next map over to the far right top by county, we see a slightly different picture, which is that for the most part, there are entirely red states. There's a few that don't have a single county in the United in their environs that voted for the Democrats. That includes Utah. It almost includes Wyoming, except for the yuppie fiefdom of Jackson Hole, Wyoming, which is mostly really wealthy people who fly in for the weekend and then fly back to Los Angeles or San Francisco after they've skied. And also the state of Idaho, and that little blue spot there is the major resort area where Robert Redford lives, and a lot of Hollywood stars. So you get this sense of a vast bulk of heartland voters, overtaking the cosmopolitan centers. Except if you look more closely, where you see the redoubts of the Democrats, even in the red states, which include the areas where there's high numbers of non-whites, such as southern Texas and the far west of Texas, near El Paso. Parts of New Mexico, which is the state that has the most blue. I suppose you can locate New Mexico on a map. It's the state next to Texas on the west. Has quite a bit of blue. That's Albuquerque, Santa Fe, and areas where there's lots of indigenous people. Those are all counties, in short, that combine what seems to be the Democrats' major constituencies, which are cosmopolitan, relatively well-educated people, along with non-white people. The rest, and that's the subject of my talk, you can go over here to the south even and find that along the Mississippi River as it drains into Louisiana, you'll see what used to be known as the Black Belt. It's the area of one time mammoth cotton plantations, where still these are majority counties of African Americans. Those are obviously, I think, the heaviest Democratic county in the United States, actually, is in the Black Belt of Mississippi, along that area. And then we see, as we move north, the furthest north in Minnesota right there, that little blue area that sticks out into Canada, above Lake Superior. I guess that's still Ontario up there at the very furthest northern point. That is the Iron Range, which is the center, actually, one of the places where the Communist Party USA had its greatest strengths in the 1930s. And Gus Hall, the chairman of the Communist Party USA, that's where he comes from. They're still hanging in there, although it's a depopulated, deindustrialized area. It used to have some of the strongest unions in the United States. So it looks a little bit more mixed, therefore, I'm trying to argue, that the monolithic quality of the blue states and the red states is a little deceptive. Because if we look again at my state, New York, there we find, my God, it's one of the heaviest Democratic states in the country. If you look at it by county, it looks pretty bleak. The only problem is that the two counties, or the four counties actually, that voted heavily Democratic, of course, are the five boroughs of New York, even Long Island, and where I live, Westchester County, which used to be a Republican bastion, voted Democratic in 2004 and 2000. The rest of the state is pretty red, except for where Cornell is and where Albany is, which has the oldest city machine in the United States, and still hangs in there for the Democratic Party. So, what's that?
And the Mohawk Reserve.
And the Mohawk Reserve in the far north, that's right, on the St. Lawrence. Exactly. But I guess what I'm trying to portray by this is that it's not quite as monolithic as it appears. We have a fair amount of competition for votes in many of the states. And of course, in the most high, and the best map of all here, which demonstrates, this is a really great map. I'm not really into maps that much, but I have to say, this is one thing we still do well in our neo-fascist country, which is we still do really good maps. I guess we need it for military ordnance and things like that. We have to really pinpoint things very closely, like in Fallujah. So the same kind of technology that brings you Fallujah also brings you these wonderful population density maps, which portrays on the far right bottom a quite different picture, where you get a sense of more of an evenness in terms of the way the population is distributed and the blue and red, with high levels of population concentration, generally speaking, looking more or at least evenly Democratic, and then the really sparsely settled regions of the country Roughly the entire mountain region in the Great Plains, very sparsely settled, mostly red with a few pockets of blue here and there, as I've described. And then finally we go over to the far left corner, bottom, and we see probably if any Canadian person can describe how the Electoral College works, you'd win a free, you know, trip to, I guess, Ohio or someplace. Most of my students, after months of explanations, still don't get it. But anyway,
this is intuitively
it's
preposterous.
Intuitively preposterous, and any reasonable person couldn't understand how it would work. But in the far left bottom, you get a sense of the electoral vote by state, which looks like it's pretty much even. You've got blue and red, and indeed that was the final outcome. The Electoral College is roughly, although not entirely, based upon population. But the nub is that partly it is and partly it ain't. So the Electoral College split in the electorate looks, you know, hey, the U.S. looks pretty divided down the middle. Not a particularly big victory for the red people, if you want to call them that. Now, having gone through that brief survey, I want to also point out a couple of things which kind of stand out in the demographics of the electorate in the United States this time. And this will lead me to sort of looking at the three, what I see as like the three major interpretations of the 2004 election, which I'll talk about after I've given you these sorts of new points and old points about how this election stacks up with previous ones. Well, at one level, this election is... Okay, let me give you the bleak stuff for the Democrats first, and Democrats and their allies, I suppose. One is that over the last 30 years, or roughly since 1968, 35 years, and even before that, but after 68 in particular, it would appear that the Democratic Party is just not a competitive party and will no longer be a competitive party in most of the states that were on the wrong side of the Civil War. And that is something completely and utterly confirmed by the 2004 election. It's one of a series of elections in which the Democrats have become much less competitive, and this time one can say that the margins of victory for the Republicans in the southern states and the border states, including Kentucky and Tennessee, are so large that if the Democrats will ever emerge as a majority party again, which I will talk about in a minute as to whether that's even a possibility, it's going to be very hard to understand how they're going to do it without winning at least one southern state in the Electoral College. Right now, the only states in which they would have a ghost of a chance of being competitive in is the very large state of Florida, which they lost pretty big time this time as compared to 2000, and possibly Arkansas, Bill Clinton's home, and possibly Louisiana, and as a long shot, possibly Virginia. But these are states in which, at the same time in the 2004 election, the remaining Democratic senators in the South, most of them retired and in new races, all the Senate seats won by the Republicans, a total of four, all but one was won in the southern states. This indicates something fairly ominous for the future of whatever's left of Democratic liberalism. On the bleak side, therefore, we have the South undergoing what our scholars call a electoral realignment. And it doesn't seem like it's particularly reversible because it's the end of a long train of realignments that have taken place since roughly the election of Nixon, Richard Nixon, in 1968. On the other hand, the good parts are the following for the Democrats. Most of the states that, as compared to 2000, where the election was won in the popular vote by the Democrats, this time, as you know, they lost by 3.5 million votes out of a total of roughly, it's not completely totaled up, but roughly 120 million or 119 million cast. The percentage is wound up as 51-48. By any measure, this is not a landslide victory. In the 1980s, Ronald Reagan won by margins of 59-41. Richard Nixon defeated George McGovern in the election of 1972 by a slightly larger margin. In short, this was a close election. And the sea of red analogy of a conservative tide is obviously something that the existing regime wishes to press on all of us so that they can conduct their, so that they can enact enormous foreign policy and domestic policy changes. That is rather an illusion given the margin of victory. And I wanted to turn, therefore, to the demographics briefly of some of the remarkable things and similar things about the demographics of this election. And what changed from 2000. First point is, really, not that much changed from the election of 2000, despite the enormous events, 9/11 and the Iraq War, and the onslaughts, various onslaughts through the Patriot Act and various other measures that the Bush administration has undertaken. If you look at it in broad terms, not that much changed between 2000 and 2004. What we had across the board almost were incremental increases for Republicans in most of the demographic groups that matter. And that includes, with one exception, which is something to worry about for people like me and probably you, the one exception is the enormous gains that the Republicans made amongst Latino voters, the fastest growing group in the American population, a group in which there's probably 6 or 7 million people who are presently not citizens, who will become citizens, roughly, one could argue, in the next 10 years. And if those demographic trends persist, that's very, very bad news for the Democrats. But virtually in all, and I will talk about why that happened, I think, in a second. But for the most part, what we saw was incremental gains in most of the demographic categories that people use to study the U.S. electorate. That is to say, Republicans gained 1, 2, or 3 points amongst white Protestants. They gained 1, 2, 3 points amongst white men. They gained 1, 2, 3 points amongst Catholics. Actually, they gained 4 points amongst Catholics. They gained 4 points, I believe, or 5 points amongst Jewish voters. And at the same time, the Democrats gained actually in a few social categories. For example, amongst new voters and young voters, the Democrats did quite well. People voting for the first time, I think the figure is an 11% margin for the Democrats over the Republicans. Amongst 18 to 29-year-olds, that's the only demographic group that Kerry actually won, and he won it by a fairly sizable margin. Since that's a group that's completely disproportionately unrepresented in the U.S. electorate, unlike Canada, I believe, that votes the least as a demographic, as an age category, and because they are now the most democratic of all age groups in the electorate, the future isn't necessarily entirely bleak. Now, the positive points for the Democrats are therefore also, and I'm sure everybody wants to talk about the question of vote suppression and vote fraud. And I wanted to say a little bit about that now. This is a very touchy subject. I have maybe a million emails that are going to be waiting for me when I return. My own view is my colleagues on the left almost universally believe that this election was stolen through outright vote fraud. As you may know, in the United States, we have this arcane, ridiculous provincial system in which basically throughout the nation, county partisan, that is to say, party-oriented officials are the supervisors of elections in virtually every state and county in the United States with no universal regulations except race-based regulations regarding how votes are counted and tallied. It's almost unbelievable. And the systems of registration of American voters, unlike Canada, for example, is a question of personal will rather than the responsibility of an impartial civil service. This dates back to the progressive era of the 1890s and early 20th century, in which vote suppression was the conscious intention of those who wished to institute forms of personal registration, so that you actually had to show up at a certain hour at a courthouse in order to register to vote. Now, despite all the changes that have occurred in many aspects of American electoral systems, we're really back to reading about 19th century forms of vote suppression. In my own view, the vote suppression does not occur by means of changing memory chips. It occurs much more through the routine ways in which people of color, working class voters, areas in which are poorly funded and have lower property tax bases, such as inner cities. If you look at Ohio, for example, where I was, the average line, somebody calculated this, the average line in Cleveland, which is a majority African-American city, the average line to vote was 5 hours. Okay? The average line where I was working in this all-white county called, believe it or not, Licking County, Ohio, near Kentucky, there was no line at all in Licking County. Okay? So it's estimated, by the way, is a college I know very well called Kenyon College, which I'm sure you've probably never heard of, but it's in Gambier, Ohio. There, the record was set for the longest line in recent voting history, 14 hours. They had a party. It's a famous kind of thing where this is a college town in which there was one voting machine for the entire Kenyon College. And it screwed up. People had to wait in line. They wound up having like drinking parties, all kinds of, you know, drug parties. Luckily, it was a nice day. It wasn't raining. The polls were kept open until 2 o'clock the next morning in order to accommodate the line. So what you do find is a lot of routine vote suppression. If you want, later on, I can tell you the myriad ways in which vote suppression occurs. It's not simply one thing. A little story. My wife dreamt up the idea. She's a union activist in Westchester. She thought up the idea of, in order to find more Democrats, of contacting the sons and daughters of people who were registered Democratic in the high school, who had graduated from our high school, Ossining New York High School, and contacting them away at college and getting them to register to vote, and then sending them absentee ballots, which is you can vote where, you know, where you are at college. So she did this, and a week before the election, she gets a call from this one woman who was an Ossining High School graduate, actually an Indian American, and this woman says that she wrote a letter for her absentee ballot, and a week before the election, she gets a letter from Westchester County, and the Westchester County Board of Elections says, you have to justify your absence from Westchester County on election day before we will send you an absentee ballot. In effect, because she received this letter a week before the election, there was absolutely no way for this person to vote. Now, how many votes are lost that way in the United States? Well, we know from the election of 2000 that 2 million votes were lost because of spoiled ballots. The famous, I don't know if you remember this ridiculous crap, the Chads, so-called overvotes, where people couldn't figure out the ballots because the ballots, I could tell you other stories about that. It's very arcane and Byzantine, and so they voted for the wrong person and tried to correct it. 2 million votes were lost in the United States. Out of that, there's a study done at USC which estimates that 1.2 million of those votes were from people of color. Okay? And the big issue this year has been the casting of something called provisional ballots. That is to say, if that person from Maryland who my wife registered to vote had driven up to Westchester County 300 miles away and had decided to go back to a precinct, and she had actually tried to vote, the registrar would have told her, oh, you applied for an absentee ballot. You can't vote here. But we'll let you cast this paper ballot, which the election judges will judge later. This year, because of a new law passed in the wake of 2000, an estimated 1.6 million provisional ballots were cast. But out of that, it's estimated probably only 400,000 will be considered legitimate. And that is at the discretion of county officials. In counties that are controlled by the Republican Party entirely, like the county I was working in, Licking County, it doesn't have one single Democratic Party official at any level. I don't think that they were going to be kind to provisional ballots. They would just say, sorry, I don't know who this person is, throw it out. And there's no one there to challenge that decision. So we have an estimated roughly 3.5 million voters in the United States who tried to cast a vote, but whose votes were disposed of. Would this have given Kerry the election? Probably not quite. If you're generous, you would give him 60 to 70% of those, something like that. He still would have lost the popular vote, but he might have come close in Ohio. Or he might have actually won Ohio, and by the magic of our electoral system, even though he lost the popular vote, with the electoral votes of Ohio, he would have won the election. On the other hand, he would have faced a Republican Senate, Supreme Court, and House, who would have probably moved to impeach him immediately. So that's my little riff on vote suppression in the United States. If you'd like to ask me more, fine. On other aspects of the election, now we can go to the interpretations, the dominant interpretations I'm sort of part of this interpretation game. I'm sure Professor Steve Newman here is part of it. I'm sure you all are, in some ways, interpreters. One interpretation which I'm trying to get rid of is that we lost because of outright fraud. I think we probably lost. We really did lose the popular vote, and we might have won if you could figure out a way of having a French Revolution which swept away all these ridiculous provincial techniques of counting, registering people. But in the absence of that, in the abstract experiment that we could undertake, we really will never know. To my mind, it's much more important, especially for people who are progressive, as we say in the U.S., it's much more progressive to address the real rise of the Republican Party and to understand exactly what kinds of strategies and interpretations may allow us, from my perspective, to overcome their dominance. And it won't suffice to simply delay this by saying they stole the election. So I'm a lone voice in this, by the way, in my email list. Everybody's saying, what's the matter with you? Join the bandwagon. I refuse to do that because I just don't believe it's going to go anywhere. The major interpretations are pretty easy to summarize. And the first is we lost because there is a right-wing proto-Nazi Republican tide. There's compelling evidence for each of these interpretations. I'm sure probably most people in Canada would agree with that interpretation.
Certainly most people here.
Yes.
Easy because we're safe.
Yes. Well, and a lot of people who live in the blue states agree with this interpretation, too. I'm sure it must have been publicized in Canada the day after Bush's victory was announced. There were, 170,000 hits on the Ministry of Immigration, Canadian Ministry of Immigration website. And actually, I wanted to turn this into a job talk, but they wouldn't allow me to do it. One interpretation is that this is part of a sequence of events which will lead pretty much to a permanent Republican electoral majority. This is favored, I think, by a lot of people on the left, as well as, of course, by the Bush administration and its major, the so-called Mayberry Machiavelli, his advisor, Karl Rove, the evil genius behind the throne, who is going around now saying that the point is to consolidate power because the Democrats are, in effect, doomed. The second interpretation, and I think this is more something close to my own. I think, by the way, this interpretation, which I want to return to, is a plausible one. The second interpretation is that, and you can tell by what I've said so far, is that this was an electoral tremor, but it will result in an institutional earthquake. That is to say, and there's a lot of reasons behind that. One is that even though not that many votes changed, the institutional arrangements are such that it gives unprecedented power to what I call America's new Leninist party, which is the GOP, which is an unprecedented political party in U.S. political history. Horrible of horribles, it's a centrally organized, disciplined, right-wing party. We've had very disorganized, undisciplined conservative parties in the past. This one seems to really know what it's about. And with the exception of what it's doing to us, it knows how to operate to maintain political power. So with only 3 million votes, or 3.5 million votes, it can accomplish tremendous results institutionally, or at least will attempt to do so. I think this is probably the dominant interpretation amongst the political scientists that probably Steve knows as well, like Skowronek. Yes, I'll again drop some names here, but that's irrelevant. And the third one, which is much favored by the people who actually lost the election, the advisors to Kerry, and which also has, I think, some basis in reason, is that this was a close election based upon conjunctural short-term factors, which can be remedied by either a right or a left-wing takeover of the Democratic Party. So that, yeah, we lost this time, but it was due to the fact that Kerry was from Massachusetts, he spoke French, he did not speak in a southern accent, so he could not draw any, quote, homeland or, quote, heartland voters. The Volk didn't like that. If we put up somebody of similar political views who doesn't speak French, who doesn't windsurf, who doesn't come from Massachusetts, and who can crack a few jokes, then we're probably going to be okay next time. There's a more sophisticated variation of that, which is that, and I think that this is much more the way I feel about it, is that insofar as the Democratic Party, the one thing I didn't mention, which I'm saving for my real topic, which I haven't gotten to yet, the one thing I didn't mention was that the Democratic Party, to those of us who are of a certain age and older, once represented, no matter how poorly, a large numbers of working class people. And the candidacy of Senator Kerry, whatever else it might have been, did not in any way address, either programmatically or rhetorically, the new kinds of structures that exist within the working class, and particularly within the cultural formation we would call the white working class. So a more sophisticated argument on this basis is not that it's Kerry the personality or Kerry the French speaker that lost. It's Kerry the globalist, corporate globalist, free trading Democrat who can say very, very little to traditional Democratic constituencies or new Democratic constituencies that lost the election. The right-wing variation of that, and this is something that the Bush administration would be very surprised to learn that Kerry was a right-winger, since they called him, there's these famous things that they always say, repeating it time after time, you know, he's so far left, he's left America. You like that? Remember that. He's so far left, he's left America. He's so far, anyway, this is repeated hundreds and hundreds of times, it's drummed into your head. I mean, John Kerry, so far left, he's left America. The guy is like, you know, I suppose in Canada he'd be considered a center right. But that's how far, I guess, we've come, which only indicates that you could say that there's a substantial segment of the corporate, business-dominated, middle-class, and affluent part of the Democratic Party which thinks that the problem is that Bush is right, that we should have nominated someone like Senator Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut, who's pro-Iraq war, pro-military. He's kind of an environmentalist. He thinks the Iraq war was good, but doesn't think it's been fought well.
Doesn't have a southern accent.
Doesn't have a southern accent. He's also Jewish, which I don't know if that's going to work out too well in Arkansas. But somebody like Joe Lieberman, except a southerner.
And a Christian,
right. So we have to think up this kind of composite. With a full head of hair and taller. Right. So this wing, which is called the Democratic Leadership Council wing of the party, or Bill Clinton could rise from the grave and run again. But not Hillary, because she's definitely considered to be so far left, she's left America, even though she's for the Iraq War. So that right and left wing interpretation, I think, sort of holds on. It's an ideological basis for dissent. So now let me turn to, is this kind of clear so far? Is this obvious? You know all this? You knew all this?
It's not cheering me up.
You don't speak English. No. You do speak English. It's okay. It's okay so far? Okay, good. Now, I want to start with the real subject, which is the place where the Democrats have lost the most votes and the place where the American political system in general is the weakest, democratically by any criterion, okay, is if you look at these maps, the one thing that's obvious if you're kind of a socialist or Marxist or you have any social democratic or socialist proclivities, whatever, or if you've ever read a book of any kind, would be that this map does not resemble anything that Karl Marx would understand or be able to comprehend in social class terms. Because if you look at a map like this, it's obviously divided in, not by social class, it's divided by je ne sais quoi. It's divided by, I don't know, region, Cosmo versus provincial. This is 19th century pre-industrial stuff. It's divided by religion, it's divided by attitudes, lifestyles, something like that, which maybe could be related to social class if you are fairly sophisticated, but in any case, the class basis of voting in the United States is not at all confirmed by looking at the stats, except if you're upper class, which is to say, the class struggle does continue at the top, but somehow at the bottom, it's not reflected in the way people vote. So some people at the top are voting economic interests, but people at the bottom and the middle are not. Okay? That's fairly obvious. So, and one of the most pathetic statistics that you can actually raise about this election is that, along with a whole series of them, the Democratic Party no longer gains the majority of votes amongst people who have a high school diploma or less. And that's not even controlling for people of color. So that a majority of people in what you might call Walmart jobs, in the burgeoning, booming service sector of McJobs, who are probably working longer hours with no health insurance, who are the most screwed by Bush's tax policies, who are most screwed by the Iraq War, the type of people that Michael Moore, I think, genuinely tried to appeal to with Fahrenheit 9/11 and in his persona, those folks at best are splitting their votes between the party of hypercapitalism, the Republicans, and the party of, I don't know, what you wouldn't call it, something more, less hyper, more humanistic form of capitalism, which at least doesn't want to throw grandma into the snow when she gets cancer, party, the Democrats. So how do we explain this? Do you have this in Canada? Do you have this kind of problem in Canada? How do you explain, in short, what might be called the right-wing surge amongst the voters that should be precisely be located as a new majority for a revived Democratic Party? And here, I think we move into truly foreign terrain for Canadians, I would guess. I want to read a quote from someone named Ann Coulter.
Oh dear. People know who Ann is. Some people know who Ann is.
Yeah, y'all know who Ann is? Okay. So, you know, this is a lot, you know, I thought this was like going to be a very, you know, like Ann Coulter, who's she? But no, okay. Well, I like this one because, I mean, it's just one. They're actually worse ones, but the whole point, notice here, there's two things to notice. One, the appeal to social class, to the working classes, but there's something missing. There's something missing from the analysis. I'm going to read, after this I'm going to read something by a guy named Mike Gold. You ever heard of Mike Gold?
No.
Okay. I'll tell you who he is afterwards. Ann Coulter. The whole point of being a liberal is to feel superior to people with less money. Only when you appreciate the powerful driving force of snobbery in a liberal's worldview do all their preposterous counterintuitive arguments make sense. They promote immoral, destructive behavior because they are snobs. They embrace criminals because they are snobs. They oppose tax cuts because they are snobs. They adore the environment because they are snobs. Liberals hate society and want to bring it down to reinforce their sense of invincibility, secure in the knowledge that their beachfront haciendas will still be standing when the smoke clears. They giddily fiddle with the little people's rules and morals. Indeed. Now, a quote from Mike Gold, who actually was a writer for the Workers' World in the 1930s, and an advocate of sort of what might be called early ideas of Gramscian hegemony, a Marxist, a communist. He was describing the upper classes of the 1930s in similar prose, except there's something missing. He was talking about the playwright Thornton Wilder, who wrote Our Town, and he was describing a class of folks who mystified, anyway, describing sort of a group of intellectuals who sort of mystified small-town America and romanticized it. He says, "It is that newly fashionable literary religion that centers around Jesus Christ, the first British gentleman. It is a pastel, a pastiche, a dilettante religion without the true neurotic blood and fire, a daydream of homosexual figures in graceful gowns moving archaically among the lilies. It is Anglo-Catholicism, that last refuge of the American literary snob." Now there we have two critiques of what you might call two ruling classes, or two visions of ruling classes. One, in Coulter's case, is based upon a liberalism which is deemed as effete, which is deemed as a set of attitudes which demeans the lives and lifestyles of ordinary people, which is seen as devoid of an economics, for the most part, except for an economics which talks in bleeding heart terms, but actually is involved in screwing ordinary people to the wall, either through words or through people's behaviors on the job, although that's not exactly mentioned. And it also represents a kind of class difference in Coulter's part, even though she herself is the daughter of a chief financial officer of a major corporation. It reveals a kind of sense about social class, which I think is very much, even though she is a bad embodiment of it, is responded to at the grassroots of the Democratic of the Republican Party. And if you look at this in other ways, there's certain kinds of cultural phenomenon going on here, which I will now try to relate in an anecdote from Licking County, Ohio, which I think has to be understood as a form of ways in which social class is expressed. Not so much people being duped by the Republicans, but social class struggle is expressed, but it's refracted in some ways to a different target. In the absence of a response to these kinds of things, it holds the day. My little humble example, and there are hundreds from other experiences that I've had in the, quote, heartland, is that when we went to Licking County, which is a county that voted 70-30 for Bush in 2000, it's virtually all white, mostly immigrants from West Virginia and Kentucky who were former coal miners. Okay, they sent us and my students, who were mostly the kinds of people misunderstood by Ed Coulter, they sent us to the poorest part of this county, which is a place called Buckeye Lake, Ohio. And Buckeye Lake is this declined resort in which basically maybe 4,000 or 5,000 white people without jobs, apparently, are living in cabins that were once tourist cabins from the 50s. When Buckeye Lake was a little bit more fashionable. It's a completely, by my lights, a completely blasted out area in which the houses are sitting up on concrete, if at best, stilts with no foundations, in which half the houses are pretty much wrecked. We were assigned to do this precinct, and to walk this precinct for the Democrats. Oddly, what we got, a couple of things. First guy I approach says, listen to me very politely, First response is, "I'm sorry, I don't vote for baby killers, period." That's it. In other words, as we honed our message, our canvassing techniques became different than the Democratic Party's, which were just talk about, you know, hi, who you, you know, what are you interested in this election? Instead, we talked about things like, are you aware that, you know, Ohio's, do you have health insurance? Do you want health insurance? It was a very kind of direct materialist approach to, and most people said, no, we don't have health insurance. No, it's terrible. The responses across the board to those kinds of questions were, yeah, but you know, what can you do? What can you do? I don't believe it's going to be any better under Kerry. And in other words, what we got predominantly was a sense, first off, that no one had ever been talked to politically. I don't. Maybe this is a liberal idea, but they've had no conversations about politics. Difference one then between the industrial working class of the past and the present would be that there's no what you might call lateral political conversations taking place in this neighborhood about politics until we outsiders arrived. Very, very bad. Obviously, in the United States, that's reflected in the fact that 30 years ago, 1/3 of our labor force was unionized. Today, a mere 13 or 12.5% is, and only 9% of private sector workers, amongst the lowest rates in the industrialized world. So what we saw, first off, a second observation I would make is that in virtually every house, the TV was on as we entered the house on a Saturday, in every house. I mean, this is not like a wonderful ethnographic observation, but it does point to the fact that the major source of information about politics in the United States for people of Buckeye Lake is predominantly through television and not through other forms of media, the internet, or all the or talking with neighbors. Interestingly, as we moved up the class structure in Licking County, Ohio, we received much more receptive people who were willing to engage in conversation. The people in Buckeye Lake weren't interested, for the most part, except for a few people, all women, by the way. I don't know, this is not statistically valid to say this. It's not all women who said, I want to get that prick out of the White House as soon as possible. And where these people come from needs further investigation. We didn't find a Republican red tide. What we found was an electorate where the subject, the agenda of politics, has been transformed. It's no longer seen, and maybe this is one of the problems with the institutional majority assumed by the Republicans. There's a disentanglement of people's everyday lives from not material struggle, but material struggle that's related at all to what government does. So that I think, in a way, this reminds me very much of the kinds of things that were written in the 1920s and early 1930s, where people would talk about the great accomplishment of our New Deal and Franklin Roosevelt was getting people to think that the government had any responsibility for the economy. From what I could tell, these folks didn't like the conditions they were living in, but the connection between those conditions and political life was so distant that in a 5-minute conversation after knocking on their door, it would be very hard to repair those connections. That's kind of a roundabout way of supporting, I suppose, the thesis of some aspect of the thesis of Robert Putnam, which I'm pretty sure you're all familiar with, about civil society. And it confirms a lot of things about some of the cultural messages that the Republicans send to folks like this to basically make politics. And the second thing that I would say was that the Republicans are able to connect and fill that void in politics with a certain kind of iconic symbolic language. Examples of these kinds of things abound. If you look at right-wing publications, and if you look at the mass organizations that the Republicans have through the churches, they emphasize certain kinds of themes over and over again. And they sound trivial, but they are related to a greater symbolic way in which they have tied working-class anger to themselves. One is the resentment of lifestyles in which, say, as simply that fat people are categorized as somehow undesirable. This is, if you look at right-wing publications, it's all through it. Another one is the resentment of lifestyles in which big words like the kinds I'm kind of using here are used, and complex arguments are made. Coulter's work, the work of the Kansas Republicans in the book What's the Matter with Kansas, which is a book I've just been reading, I talk a lot about there's this kind of cult of simplicity. The populism takes the form of loving Bush because even though he may appear as an inarticulate clown to us, the very fact that he makes mistakes, the very fact that he assumes a kind of lifestyle which appears to ape the kinds of conditions that ordinary people have is, in the absence of an alternative, extraordinarily attractive. Another example is many conversations about Walmart. My wife has tried to organize Walmart stores, which are notoriously difficult. It's the biggest nut to crack of any organization in the United States. You talk to Walmart workers. When she talks to Walmart workers, they're saying, well, why do you guys look down on us because we work at Walmart? They say, no, it's not a question of looking down on you. Or why do you look down at Walmart, at people who shop at Walmart? In other words, the use of a lifestyle question to sort of say, you're being demonized for working at Walmart, whereas the union organizing approach, the class-based approach, would say, we want to organize you. We don't hate you for working at Walmart. We want to organize you for more power at the workplace. What this is, in short, is a kind of class resentment of expertise, a kind of class resentment of sophistication and cosmopolitanism, which then gets refracted utterly away from economics, utterly away from the classic field of what you might call socialism and Marxism, onto cultural norms, such as you're looking down on me because I'm fat, you're looking down on me because I'm a Walmart worker, you're looking down at me because I live in a depressed area like Buckeye Lake. Well, screw you. The exploitation of that by the Republicans is to exploit more or less, in short, A-class resentment to fit into a symbolic icon of nationalism and the honoring of the people's conditions, no matter where they may be found. So that the idea of being poor, so what? I still got my dignity. The idea of liberals taking away your guns becomes the ways in which politics is reconstructed over to people's personal cultural identities. Now, I see I've gone over time already. If you'd like some further kinds, I mean, this is not much of a pop analysis, but to conclude the talk, we need to figure out how the Democrats could recapture this. One of the ways that I would say that these interpretations all fall through that I gave at the origins of the talk or at the middle of the talk was that most of the interpretations underestimate the extent to which the Democrats have become demographically a little bit like what the Republicans stereotype says they are. That is to say, there is, in the numbers, more people with postgraduate education vote for the Democrats now than the Republicans. Even amongst people who make $150,000 a year, we're seeing the Democrats and Republicans almost pulling even. Very rich people still vote Republican 2-1. But the Democrats are getting closer in those highly professional categories and groups. Now, I don't know if there's a problem with that, but what it does is it tilts the Democratic Party socially and culturally away from even thinking about organizing seriously in the, quote, white working class heartland. It makes people like myself almost culturally unable to really speak to those folks. And the proof of the pudding of this is the one statistic that really stands out for Democratic success is the following. I don't want to overestimate the case that white working class people vote Republican, because there's one statistic that still stands out. Amongst those groups that are still unionized, amongst the 25% of the electorate that comes from a union household, which is a quarter of the American electorate and only 13% of the overall population, but a quarter of the electorate, you see universally high levels of mobilization, and you see a vote for the Democrats of about 61-39. That ain't great, but it's pretty damn good compared to the non-unionized workers in which the voting percentages are pro-Republican. So if the Democrats are ever going to come back, they need to do a couple of things. They need to duplicate. First off, they need to stop saying things like Kerry said when asked, for example, I don't know if you saw any of the debates. He would say things like, well, what are you going to do about poverty, basically, Larry, he's asked. He says, well, we're going to take away those tax cuts for people who make over $200,000 because the deficits are going to grow. A valid point. It's a good policy wonk approach. But not once did you hear from Kerry, nor once did you hear from Albert Gore, nor once really after 1992 did you hear much from Clinton. A very simple premise, which is, no, we're going to tax people who make over $200,000 a year, not because of the deficits. We're going to tax them because we live in a society, in an economy, in which millions of people are being thrown into poverty, in which they're losing their pensions, and it is unjust and immoral to reward the rich with more tax cuts in a period when millions are suffering. We don't hear that language from the Democrats. Why we don't hear that language may in itself be a concession to the fact that they've become a much more right-wing centrist party. But when we talk that language, when unions talk that language, when the American labor movement in its organizing talks that language, I think it could be more effective. And it could be more effective in the heartland, the so-called heartland, because it shifts the moral discourse and to symbols that ordinary people understand, as opposed to the language of policy wonks, deficits, the cultural critique of Bush as a stupid person, which I think he's an unintellectual person, but to call him stupid was then seen as insulting to people who themselves think of themselves as stupid. These are all complex, and I realize very generalized ideas, but I therefore think that the Democrats can come back, but to come back, it basically means that they would have to recover their mass democratic, their Rooseveltian roots under these new circumstances of millions of service workers. To do that means that they have to spend a lot more time in organizing. To do that means they have to spend a lot less time pursuing the so-called swing voters, the confused people in the middle who can't make up their mind. And there's some move in the Democratic Party, as a final note. There's a lot of encouraging things. There's a lot of organizations that came out of the anti-war movement and also out of the unions, which millions of people in this election worked in. We didn't win, but we gained 6 million votes. I've never seen, and I've been in politics, in campaign politics a long time, I have never seen the level of activism ever in the United States amongst people volunteering ever. And I've been very involved in many, many campaigns. I've never seen the level of intensity. And we did win some victories. We did increase turnout amongst core groups. The unfortunate thing is that the Republicans did, too. So to conclude this rather rambling essay, please fire away and let me know what's on your mind. Okay?
Well, thank you, Ray.